Welcome to the Midday for a Thursday. I'm Norman Gilliland in our Buck studio now as we look forward to some illustrations, musical illustrations of a couple of really major, and I should say also crowd-pleasing works of music. The Madison Symphony is performing this weekend. It's their season opener for the 2014-15 season. Concerts Friday night at 7:30, Saturday night at 8, and Sunday afternoon at 2:30. And with me is the conductor of the Madison Symphony, Maestro John Demain. Welcome back.
Thank you, Norman. Good to be back.
At the piano there, ready to launch into music at any time. But this is a really action-packed program you have here because you've got Also Sprach Zarathustra, the Richard Strauss tone poem, and you have the Organ Symphony of Camille Saint-Saëns, which is also wonderful themes and so powerful. And then in between, you have a much lesser-known work, but certainly one worth discovering, which is that Concerto for Seven Winds and Percussion and Strings by the Swiss composer, 20th-century Swiss composer Frank Martin. So you have all kinds of tie-ins there. You've got plenty of percussion between the first two and, of course, the organ tying in the first and the third. Brilliant program.
Actually, we have the percussion tying in all three because in the last movement of the Martin, there's a big timpani solo.
Right.
Yep. A wonderful timpani solo, and there are percussion players playing in it.
So there are lots going on. And, of course, I guess I'd have to say that the headliner, though, is that you get to show off again that organ in the Overture Center, that fantastic instrument.
The Kleiss organ, yeah. It's really a major asset for us, and it's a colossal instrument, really beautiful. And I look at this is the 10th anniversary of Overture Center for the Arts, and it's our 10th anniversary playing in Overture Hall. And that has been very meaningful for us. I mean, this was it really changed our lives to move into having a real hall designed for music and for symphony and opera and as well as the other things that go on there and ballet as well. And it has been a joy for us to have finally a real performing arts center. And we opened 10 years ago with the Saint-Saëns.
Yes, I remember well. I didn't get to hear it. I had to hear that from the lobby because I was on my way back from Scandinavia, and I remember sitting on my suitcase in the lobby of the Overture Center because I wanted to hear that Saint-Saëns organ symphony.
Yeah, and I remember how thrilling. We had to encore the last movement because the audience went so wild, to hear that instrument.
Sure.
It was also important to me, when we were designing the hall, that and when we were participating in making decisions about the hall, is that we visited some other halls. And, the important halls have an organ as part of their component, and the European halls, many of the American halls. And so we thought it'd be great to have it. And Pleasant Rowland, of course, stepped forward and gave us the gift of this fantastic organ. And of course, it plays in the first piece as well.
It doesn't play as much,
but it makes a powerful noise.
And it's a very powerful beginning, too. Also Sprach Zarathustra, Thus Spake Zarathustra of Richard Strauss, if I remember right, was one of the pieces that when CDs first came out, they used that as a test piece because the dynamic range is so broad.
Oh, really?
Especially beginning with that opening, I'll call it about 15 seconds, it's almost subaudible.
Way down there.
Yes. What is it, organ and double basses?
It's the double basses, the organ, and a bass drum rumbling. And of course, this is based on a book, Also Sprach Zarathustra, in English we would call him Zoroaster.
Yes.
He was a Persian prophet who was a prophet of a pagan dynasty, but he left his family and went into seclusion for a long time, in hermetic existence, seeking a higher spirituality. And he's emerging from this long period to share his discoveries and what he's learned. And so there's the sunrise. And of course, it's that famous, everybody knows this,
a chord from the organ. And the orchestra cuts off, and the organ is still there, you know, blowing out of the room. What's significant about this, though, is that Zarathustra is a struggle between man's base instincts and nature and the search for this Übermensch, this spiritually highly developed person. And nature is represented. It's so fascinating to me. Here's this, the perfect intervals, perfect fifth and the perfect fourth. And those perfect intervals represent the basic strength and profundity of nature. And this piece has two things going for it, and Strauss introduces it right from the beginning. And that is this constant alternation between major and minor. So you get it right from the beginning, minor, major, and then you get major, minor. And then as soon as that's over, we begin to get the suggestion of the inquiring spirit of man, the searching, and we get that immediately with... And that's a very important theme. And of course, Nietzsche felt that organized religion, and particularly he went after the Catholic Church in his thinking, actually put a cap on man's ability to freely develop his spirituality. So right at the beginning, he cynically spoofs the plain song, Credo in unum Deum in unum. And then he has this sort of very beautiful, but basically this is a spiritual, as man knows it, as a religious expression, this first theme that comes in, this beautiful section in which the orchestra is all split up divisi like a chamber orchestra. Beautiful.
It is, and very, very late 19th century,
yeah,
kind of romantic.
But then he's going to burst out of that very soon and go back over to B major. As he's beginning his search. But the struggle in this piece goes right from the beginning. Right the very next measure we get, nature. Spirit. And then we get more statements. We get the Magnificat. And then we have this, which is a bursting out kind of motif that starts to burst out. And the whole orchestra gets into that motive, arriving at one of his chapters of joys and passion. But again, this is based in man's more carnal base nature. And this is this theme. Notice that even though it's a burst of joy and passion, it's in C minor, which makes it, you know, lesser yes. than a full exuberant outburst, which will happen later on in the spiritual.
Almost has this modal Mideastern quality to it.
Oh, interesting. And, you know, the other thing is, so, and then we go, we have a chapter called The Dirge, in which he takes the spiritual quest. And this passion theme that we just heard calms everything down. And then even that section climaxes with a brief statement of nature's in there.
Lest we forget.
Lest we forget. But it doesn't stay there for very long. He went through a period of learning, and it's interesting, of science and learning. And so Strauss takes eight chapters from this book, and he uses it as a springboard to create this composition. And what's interesting is, what I think is interesting is, you know, when you have the C major scale, here's B and C, and this piece is all about B and C, but B major does not lead to C, and B minor does not lead to C, when B is part of a G7, it does. But he, so these worlds have a distance between them, but he's putting them together. And so the way he expresses this sort of erudite period of learning is he writes a very dry fugue, with the fugue sort of being the most sort of erudite kind
of music,
piece of music to write. And he writes it, and you notice he takes the sunrise theme, very low, and then he goes right to B minor, which is the spirit theme. And then he starts his fugue. The other thing is that right there is all 12 notes of the scale.
Uh-huh.
Right? We have all 12 notes present. So he has major, minor, three different keys. He has E-flat, A-flat, E-flat, A-major, D-flat, C, and B-minor. He has five keys, 12 tones. So he went as intellectual as he could still to try to write a listenable piece of music. And then when everybody's had enough of that, the spirit theme comes again, you know, and it quickly gets into major, right? And we think that we're going to have this burst of joy. In fact, we even get a little bit of this dance movement, you know, which we're going to get later on. But it only lasts for a very short time. We're not ready yet to fully have taken on the Superman, the super learning. And so we go right back to this struggle again between that and the B section, but and the B minor. But what's significant now, though, is that there's something else that happens, too, and that is earlier on. I love this because earlier on, when we had the passion motive, and we were playing this theme that goes, you know, and it finally, when the or it gets, it just keeps building and building and building, and finally, when Zoroaster has had enough of this, and even in the and Strauss says when he's had enough of this,
and when the
then
audience
comes
has
this thing called this is called the satiety motive, and that means, you know, sated. I've had enough of you,
right.
And we get we get it from every instrument. We get it all over the place. But the first time it's announced, it's like putting the brakes on this base expression of passion and joy, limited as it is in scope. And this will happen throughout. Whenever Strauss has had enough of this section, or Nietzsche has, out comes this Satan movement. And actually, at the very end, when the chimes strike midnight for the Night Wanderer's lead, it is a constant. And then it gets then it gets real slow, constant, and it sort of, and in that, Zarathustra saying, "Beware, beware!" Man is seeking his higher self, and it's interesting. I mean, I don't think we have, or is it necessary to do every chapter? Except that there's that, but I think it's interesting to note, because it's kind of controversial, that when Strauss finally comes through with Zoroaster or Zarathustra making his big discovery and going and joining in a wild dance for joy as he has realized his mission on Earth and this whole idea of the Übermensch or the Superman, which is in spirit, he uses a waltz, in a way, a strange choice, right? Because you have this.
I wondered about that. So often, dance music can be used, Smetana does it in Mavlas, for example, as a way to kind of look back on an innocent past during the course of this long detailing of some kind of biographical chronology. But what is Strauss up to here? He uses waltzes in curious places like the Rosenkavalier, where they're anachronistic, for example.
I know. And I mean, I just think he probably was in love with that form of joy. Uh-huh. The waltz meant a lot to him. And of course, here you have that major theme again, you know, as the waltz starts out that way. But and it just goes into, you get that the earlier dance. So it just breaks into an exuberant dance. But I think at the end, just to jump through all of this and get to the end, what is kind of interesting is that there is this momentary spiritual triumph of sort of going to spiritual heaven here. And you get this, which was exemplified earlier up high, you know, in thirds, which is such a beautiful... And we go through all of that, and we finally arrive. You know, we're in B major, and we are B major and B minor back and forth, and then we finally arrive at the end in B. Oh no! Nature C
puts in yet another appearance.
B, nature, C, B, C, B, C, B, C, C, C. So nature gets the last word, meaning that whatever man and from Nietzsche's point of view, he thinks that man invented God the way man invented other gods, and that nature is the one unbending, and not only that, but in full control of what's going on, you know, and it's nature that the way the earth, the planets, it just is, it moves in its force and nothing can change it. So he gives, even after all of this quest, he gives nature the final say.
It was a very gentle say, however.
But I think for the audience, it's interesting to know that struggle is going on and how close that struggle is together, because they're a half step apart, B minor and C major, you know, all night long, and major and minor. So anyway, interesting piece based on a kind of existential, you know, theory that maybe some people still subscribe to, and I think that it was a period that Strauss was going to. The interesting thing is that it helped him organize materials to make a really exhilarating piece that shows off the orchestra. I mean, before that dance starts, I mean, the orchestra's in the stratosphere up high, and the you know, it's like a cock-a-doodle-doo as the dawn arrives and we burst into this dance. And what he asks the orchestra to do is really incredibly virtuosic. And so I thought it'd be a great way, since we're celebrating. We throw the focus on the orchestra for the first concert and the glorious acoustics of Overture Hall.
I have heard a couple of lower string players say this is really tough stuff.
There are licks that where that bursting out mode of it comes, all these different keys, that's really hard.
And he actually starts, two or three of the sections with the low strings, doesn't he?
Oh, sure. I mean, even the fugue starts down there. The first opening starts. And, you know, because he's coming from this, I mean, Mahler did it too in a way, you know, coming from the basic, base earth, man's baseness, and then rising through a higher spirituality. And so while that piece is there, when the you know, you're way up here. You're the other extreme, as the spirit is supposedly, you know, making this great discovery and taking over, and man is developing into a higher state.
There can't be too many works that are orchestrated to include organ and piano, which piano is sometimes played four hands. That's very different, isn't it?
Well, the Saint-Saëns, I mean, according to Saint-Saëns, he put everything, including the kitchen sink, into the piece and the ideas. But also he ended up, you know, in a way, he felt that the finale of his organ symphony was that he would never be able to top that.
Yeah, yes. And, of course, there's some reason to believe he was, let's see, he was about 50 when he wrote it. Of course, he wrote for another, 30 years or so. Saint-Saëns didn't turn out good stuff, but nothing, I guess you would say, this ambitious. We'll get into the Saint-Saëns. We're also going to get into that piece that I mentioned earlier that's in between these two giants of music, the Saint-Saëns and the Zarathustra. That would be the piece by Frank Martin. We'll get to that. We'll get to the quiz question, all of that in the next few minutes, right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. There you go. You get a little fanfare for this part of the midday from John Demain at the piano here in our Buck studio. This weekend, he's conducting the Madison Symphony, 10th anniversary season for Overture Center for the Arts, which is where they're going to be performing, which is where they usually perform in those concerts, as usual, Friday and Saturday nights and Sunday afternoon, 7:30, 8 o'clock, and 2:30, respectively. Big program with Also Sprach Zarathustra by Richard Strauss, and the other end of it, you've heard us mention, the Symphony No. 3, which is the famous organ symphony of Camille Saint-Saëns, and in between, a relatively slender piece by the 20th century Swiss composer Frank Martin. But before we get into that, John, I have a quick question about the scores you're using. Are these reductions? Are they original arrangements by the composers, or exactly what is their origin?
What do you mean the scores I'm using?
What you're playing from.
I'm playing from the full score.
The full score, but just a piano. You're playing it on the piano instead of...
Yeah, I'm trying to read all the lines at the same time.
I was
going to
say.
Which is why I play so badly. I mean, actually, you could go and find online, especially on that IMPLS website, which is free, you can find a piano version of Zarathustra. So you could sort of play it on the piano if you wanted to, you know, and download it. But I try to learn my scores always from the full score. So it's slower, but I'm much more aware of everything that's going on all at the same time, because if I stay too long. For example, when I'm learning an opera, if I stay too long in a piano vocal score, when I go to the orchestra score, it doesn't look like what I've just been studying, you know, compressed to two lines.
A little bit of a learning curve,
you know,
to return to.
And so the faster I get to that full score, so everything I'm looking at today is the full score.
Reading several different clefs at a time. And
right, kind of, and wow. I mean, so I just can pick at it because it's just too many lines to play with great fluidity.
I thoroughly understand. And now back with Maestro John Demain and this work by Frank Martin. What made you choose this it's actually not that small. It's almost 20 minutes long, isn't it? This
22 minutes, it's
concerto.
The composer says. I don't know what we're doing it at. I hopefully around 22 minutes. It's a delightful piece. I first heard it with the principal players of the Houston Symphony, playing it with the Houston Symphony under Christoph Eschenbach. And I thought, what a delightful piece to listen to and to throw focus on our principal players. And as I said, you know, this concert Orchestral Splendor is the name of this concert, throws focus on the orchestra and the musicians in the orchestra. And so I like to feature either a concerto and this is a kind of concerto grosso, as we have seven soloists playing in various combinations, both showing off soloistically in groups with the winds, with the brass, and in constant dialogue with a big string section also. You know, I noticed that subsequent recordings have often been made with chamber orchestras.
Yes.
Because it only calls for strings and percussion. But the original, I think the first recording ever made was Ernst Ansermet with the Orchestra Swiss Romand, and Frank Martin was alive and would have supervised that. And so, and it really works. I mean, it's very transparent. I mean, sometimes there's only one stand of strings playing, but when the whole section plays in some of these big passionate outbursts, it's very, very effective.
Written in 1949 by a composer who was, an original. I don't know. Would you cite influences on the work of Frank Martin?
I think that, he was neoclassical, He certainly was interested, I think, in Schoenberg when he was growing up, but I think that he moved away from that, you know, and stayed in a more conservative mainstream work. This work has dissonance in it, of course. It's a 1949 work. But at the same time, it also has consonance and tonality, and it has real shape so that you can, you know, you can follow it. It begins, the first one begins with a fanfare, you know, and this and that's all you really have to know. Bam, 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 because you're going to, and then different instruments take off in a flight of virtuosity from the soloist, but the little, that little burst always comes. It could be developed a little bit more, but that sort of divides it up a little bit. And in the first movement, for me, the first movement is quite joyous. It has a fabulous and complicated counterpoint between all of the instruments. I'm not going to even attempt to play seven of these at the same time, but I will talk a little bit about the slow movement, because in the slow movement, Martin has decided that it all takes place over the sort of ostinato pulsation of what could be a ticking clock. So you have, for example, this opening, and this just goes, and against that, the first statement comes not from the soloist, but from the strings. It's very beautiful, and it goes from there. So, and that clock is sort of with us throughout, and then the various soloists play variations on that very same thing. There's a big melodic outburst from the whole string section, you know, that goes sort of in a big. It sort of develops that. So when the string section takes over, it's very, very powerful. But it doesn't overwhelm the soloist, because don't forget, you've got three brass instruments right there in front, and it's very skillfully written. The last movement is starts out in three-quarter time in a. And it starts there, but it quickly goes into some multiple rhythms and ultimately into a march and a very exciting stretto ending, very fast. And again, the significance is the way he demonstrates the capabilities of the solo instruments, both from their lyrical and beauty of sound properties to also asking them to do some pyrotechnics on their instruments as well.
And these solo instruments are all wind instruments?
Right. All it's a concerto for seven, because we technically, you know, trumpet, trombone, and horn is considered a wind instrument, although we put them into a brass category. Mm-hmm. But it's flute, oboe, clarinet, bassoon, one trumpet, one horn, and trombone. And then in the last movement, the timpani has a big famous solo. I mean, you know, sometimes it's excerpted when timpanists take an audition, because they have to be able to play that. And so John Judson will play that. And there's a couple other percussion used very sparingly throughout the work. And so, and what I'm going to do is I will have the seven soloists seated right in front of me in the front with the strings behind. And then I'm not going to stand on the podium, so I don't tower over them, so I'm just going to stand on the floor. Because
staging is part of it, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I wanted them to stand up, but actually they'll play better sitting down.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the bassoon can play standing up. But mm-hmm. it's a very heavy instrument, so it's much better if she's sitting down, for example. I mean, the flute, oboe, clarinet, it doesn't make as much difference. I think horns certainly can play standing up, but I think that it's just everybody can be more focused when they're seated in a circle. You know, if I put on an overture hall stage, it curves, you know, and it curves outward rather than inward.
Right.
So I can't string them out on the stage because they have no contact with me or each other. So I have to put them in front of me.
Well, that is sort of concerto grosso.
That's exactly
style.
What I was, you read my mind. It's very much the concerto grosso idea.
Well, we're going to look at the next piece on that program in just a minute, and that is the powerful and certainly memorable Symphony No. 3 of Camille Saint-Saëns. That, and I'll repeat our 12:30 quiz question after this here on WPR. And now back with Maestro John Demain. He's going to be conducting the season opener of the Madison Symphony Orchestra this weekend already. It's September 19th, that's Friday, at 7:30, the 20th, which is Saturday at 8 o'clock, and Sunday afternoon at 2:30, with a big, powerful program that's going to be showing off the big, powerful Overture Center organ, and the three pieces being Also Sprach Zarathustra of Richard Strauss, the Concerto for Seven Winds, Percussion and Strings by Frank Martin, and the Symphony No. 3, the Organ Symphony of Camille Saint-Saëns. And, you know, I never noticed this, John, but you were just playing the opening notes of that, and it does echo the Tristan Liebestod that we
just the idea
heard
that
at the top of the hour.
You know, it just starts from nowhere, you know, and it makes this big crescendo, and then... So it's his way of... It's a different way of doing a sort of slow... you know, opening before the, you know, from the old school before the theme sets in. But, you know, it's interesting, ruminating on leitmotif. Of course, Beethoven sort of gave us the real example of what you could do with a small...
Yeah, four notes.
Four notes and all of that. But, and while this Saint-Saëns is also very, very unified through its thematic structure, which we will see in a second, by the time you get to, you know, 1896 and Strauss is writing and Wagner is writing, these leitmotifs have sort of taken over music. I think interesting about Zarathustra is that it was easy to use a program. And often these composers, you know, Berlioz has a whole story that applies to the Symphonie Fantastique, and so those motives are happening all the time.
But with abstract music.
Yeah, and Strauss would go after Don Juan and Don Quixote, but here he went after a philosophical tract and found a musical vocabulary. So the Zarathustra is filled with leitmotif piling on top of one another, but all having a meaning and working its way towards, and also just working its way through musically, because you should be able to take the program away, not know anything about the program, and enjoy listening to the music.
Right, of course, yes.
I just think that there's so much more to enjoy in a piece like Zarathustra when you know a little bit about the program, you know, a little bit of the struggle that's going on.
The more you know, the better.
Yeah, because then these key jumping around makes sense to you. And Saint-Saëns is using leitmotif, but not quite in the same way.
I mean, is there even a program in this work?
No.
It's just pure abstract music.
It's abstract music, but linked heavily through a transformation. And that is that when we get the first statement, which is played very fast, but I'll play very slowly. You know, the first statement. So just playing it on harmony. Is minor. That's the minor statement of that theme. And then, of course, it... And off we go, and we are constantly coming back to we're going to come back to that, the whole movement,
which is okay. A great motif. I mean, there's just something very memorable, very catchy,
very, you know, and of course jumping through hoops for a second when we finally get to and it's so interesting because he never lets us get too far away from that theme, even in the scherzo, at the very end of the scherzo, before he gets into the famous last movement, right before we're reminded once more how that theme played in the beginning, which was, but still, it's now it's, but it's now transformed very quietly to major key. And then it's going to sit on a G major, and then we're going to get, you know, the big burst of the organ, and we're going to get this beautiful statement of the same opening, but we're going to get it. Only this time we're going to do, which I can't do because I only have two hands. One piano, four hands.
Yes.
And I guess this is sort of heaven, you know? I mean, it's very glittery. And
it does,
I mean,
have
I,
that quality.
I sort of think of it, you know, as the angels jumping around and having fun in heaven. And then, of course, when that little filigree is over, then the organ gets to come in and give us... playing the Great Gate of Keys.
Well, yes, I know. It's very triumphant, isn't it?
You know,
whatever's going on there.
And, of course, the organ, of course, being the king of instruments, makes an incredible noise.
Now, at what point in this symphony, and it's not really accurately called, I'm told, an organ symphony because the organ, it's not like the organ has a presence all the way through, but at what point does the organ put in this dramatic appearance?
Well, the thing is that the first time the organ plays is... first of all, this is a four-movement symphony, but Saint-Saëns does something a little bit outrageous in that he puts two movements together and two movements together. So he combines the first and second movements, and he combines the third and fourth. But when he gets to the end of the first movement, in which he starts having fun with the theme, again, you know, he'll still... There's that theme again, and he puts in B minor, and he's working his way, and then he starts doing something where he breaks the theme up. Well, he does this both in the exposition and the recap, you know, where he goes, yum bum, wump bum, yum bum, wump bum. And even there, it's in major, but it's very subtle, bum bum. And he takes a little fragment of that, and then all of a sudden, we are in this, in the very beginning of the symphony, we had this, after this Wagnerian kind of opening, we have this little repetition of the bass. So if we look over here, right before the second movement starts, we get, like the beginning, very softly, organ. Slow movement. Organ starts here. Strings. Thank you. So this entire slow movement features the organ in dialogue with the orchestra. And it's a very beautiful, but it's the organ in its, you know, quasi-flottando, the sort of reedy, very, very gentle aspect of the organ. It's interesting, the Sasson, you know, first uses the organ very, very delicately. And he doesn't give away the organ's power until the transformation into the last movement.
Right, yes, that's where it really comes in powerfully. Does the organ ever have any, I mean, it certainly doesn't have a cadenza, but does the organ have any real solo moments in this, or is it always interwoven with the orchestra?
I think it's always interwoven with the orchestra.
So it's really part of the texture.
It's part of the texture, but at times it's, you know, as I said, when it's playing the big melody at the end, it's in charge.
Well, yeah, it's hard to compete with
that
particular instrument.
Yeah, I know.
Even with a full orchestra.
4,000 pipes, right?
Some of them very low, getting used to some of those low registers that you'll hear in these pieces.
Right.
But
the beautiful thing about the Kleist organ is the fact that when he built it, he tried very much to emulate the real sounds of instruments. He made a point 10 years ago to say, this is not a church organ. It's not a pipe organ for the church. He said, this is a concert organ in the concert hall. And indeed, the organ blends so incredibly beautifully with the symphony orchestra. And the important thing to know is it was designed for that purpose.
Sure, yes. You know. And your organist is going to be?
Sam Hutchison. You know, our curator and the great Sam Hutchison, who is so beloved. And you know, I'm happy to say that it's what I hoped would happen because, you know, I'm married to the wonderful Barbara, a German woman. And when we go to Germany, you know, and there's so many concerts with organ, you know, in churches and in concert halls. And the organ has an artistic life of its own as a concert instrument. And it was my hope that when this organ would get born, the same thing would happen. And of course, we have our own organ series, and the series this year is going to have the famous Westminster Choir. And, you know, subscriptions to the series have been really quite fantastic.
Organ notwithstanding, is a piece like this Organ Symphony of Saint-Saëns, is it particularly challenging to get the balance right so that nobody drowns out anybody else at the wrong point?
Well, we don't have any problem with how loud the organ wants to play on that last movement. You know, I mean, it's orchestrated.
That's what it's there for.
it's orchestrated in a way that it absolutely can be predominant and can thrill you, and sort of the whole thing is a sonic, you know, explosion of aural splendor. And but I think, you know, where you do want to work is earlier on. You know, the texture, the piano texture, the stops that Sam uses that blend in with the orchestra so that they don't dominate, but they underpin. And of course, the organ has a great dynamic range in that regard, so that's not a problem. But I always have a pair of ears out in the audience, uh-huh, because you know, the organ's right in front of me, and I like to see how it mixes out there to make sure that the balances are okay. But so far this week, we haven't really had a problem. As a matter of fact, at the end of one of those in the Zarathustra, there's a restatement, really loud. And it really goes. And then there's this big silence, and we go back to the other side again. You know, but and the organ makes it, and the whole orchestra was at full strength, and the organ came in, and it wasn't enough. And Sam was being tasteful. And so I said, do you have anything more? And he said, as a matter of fact, I do. And so we were able to find a sound where the organ could, because don't forget, there's 100-plus musicians on that stage playing Zarathustra. So, you know, but the organ was able to find a stop that could dominate that.
Now, so you're actually expanding the orchestra for Zarathustra. Is that true of the Saint-Saëns also?
Strauss calls for not only 16 first violins, and normally you would have 14 second violins. He calls for 16 second violins, and he calls for 12 cellos instead of 10. So normally you have 16, 14 seconds, 12 violas, 10 cellos and 8 basses, but we have 12 cellos, and so it's a big string section. But you also have 6 horns, and we have an associate principal that brings relief to the principal horn.
Well, Strauss loved his horn music. His father was a hornist.
Oh, and boy, does he write for them, you know, so gorgeously. And I mean, you know, orchestras live to play this music because it really every instrument gets a chance to explore what they're able to do. You've got 4 trumpets, 2 tubas, 2 harps.
2 harps.
Yeah. So you have really a lot. It's a huge orchestra. The Saint-Saëns is it's a big orchestra, but you don't have 6 horns. You have 4. You know, you have the more normal complement, but you do have the 1 piano, 4 hands.
And how does he use that?
That was when we did this.
Okay.
That's
Sure, of course.
Two's going like this, and the other's going like this.
Has that angelic quality. And, yeah, of course.
And then. In the scherzo, you know. In the scherzo, that's 1 piano. Dan Lyons, our orchestra pianist, plays that himself. So you've got all those different combinations. So he's got 3, you know, he's got 2 different keyboards. He's got the organ and piano. And,
well, right, which is very unusual.
Very unusual. So as I said, in a way, he threw everything in, including the kitchen sink. You
know. Well, John DeMaine, thanks for coming by and filling us in on just a few of the things that are going on in these pieces that you're going to be playing this weekend. And they are, again, Also sprach Zarathustra of Richard Strauss, and the Concerto for 7 Winds, Percussion and Strings is going to show off all of those wind players. That's by Frank Martin. And the Symphony No. 3, the Organ Symphony of Camille Saint-Saëns. Big program showing off a lot of instrumentalists, as you say. It's a way to show off the members of the orchestra. Well chosen to do that.
Well, thank you.
Always
a
pleasure.
We're looking forward to the weekend, and I hope you know, all of you out there won't miss this great, you know, opportunity to celebrate 10 years of the Madison Symphony in Overture Hall.